America is turning 250 years old. Is it also turning socialist? Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my excellent and wonderful colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward, Matt Welch, and Nick Gillespie. Matt, I want to start with you here. So last week, trio candidates. We talked about this on the podcast last week. All these folks backed by New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani, either affiliated with the DSA directly or indirectly affiliated with them, some sort of ties to the Democratic Socialists of America. They swept through New York's Democratic primaries, beating a bunch of old school, kind of traditionalist legacy Democrats, which I think is a big part of this story. We have spent the last 15 years talking about the libertarian moment, and then with Trump, the authoritarian moment. So is this kind of a socialist moment?
At least in a micro way, sure it is. I mean, it's not just the heavily blue districts in Manhattan and the Bronx, but I think in the Senate primary in Maine with Graham Plattner, that's kind of interesting. And the Democratic primary in, for the Senate in Michigan also is showing that there's some enthusiasm, like hearts are quickening in places over people who are being more just kind of like out and socialist and proud. There's also a backlash against it, even within the caucus, the Democratic Party in Congress. So I don't know how much that is going to play out in places that aren't deep blue or whatever, but it's clear that there's a fascination with this now. And I think that there's been a discovery among the DSA and some other people that the thrill that Donald Trump showed, and in his own way, Bernie Sanders before, of like, I can break the Overton window. I can now talk about a thing. I can now do horrible tweets and only have to back away from some of them and still get away with it. Not just get away with it, but have people like me because of it. That can be exciting for people who have more marginal political ideologies. I think we're seeing that right now.
Catherine, I want to ask you about this piece that ran in the Wall Street Journal opinion section recently. It's by friend of Reason, Cliff Asness, and Reason contributor, Aaron Brown. And the headline is kind of the thesis here. Trump opened the window for the DSA. The key line from this piece is that it was obvious that the damage from Donald Trump wasn't limited to the things Donald Trump himself did. It included what he would make permissible after him. So what do you make of this argument? Did Donald Trump enable the rise of American socialism?
No. And, I think the piece is actually really good. And it has all of the to be sures that you would expect from a smart pair of dudes. And these two dudes are very smart. They say people are responsible for their own actions and socialists are going to do bad things. And that's going to be on the socialists and all that. But I think like all politics is pendulum, like all politics is backlash. And so in some sense, yes, we have a like we broke the norms and then we get the ideological backlash. But with the broken norms thing, that's true. That's true. But I am very inclined to lay anything bad that socialists do squarely at the doorsteps of the socialists. And likewise for Donald Trump. But I am less convinced about like a deep connection between those things.
Well, Nick, I'm curious what you make of this, because, back during Trump's first term, we kind of sparred on the pod sometimes about Donald Trump and particularly about, his character and about it doesn't matter whether he's, sort of a vulgar type, right, which was a real complaint that a lot of people had. And I think that you see reflected in this piece by Asness and by Aaron Brown. But I've been thinking about this a little bit differently since reading that piece. You can make that argument, but there is this other thing that has happened, especially in Trump's second term, where Trump has governed not as a DSA socialist Mamdani type directly, certainly not somebody who's like citing that as an inspiration, but he's out there nationalizing companies. He's restricting the labor market. He is, basically saying the entire economy runs through me. This is a kind of populist, nationalist, socialist adjacent style of governing that I think he has brought into the Republican mainstream.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that completely. And he was, he was held back in his first term, partly by kind of political will, but also by his own choices and things like that. This time he was like, fuck it, I'm probably not going to get a third term. So he went all in with people who are total yes men. I think, it was true in 2016 that Trump was as much an effect as a cause of anything that was coming along with him. I think that is still true. And I think that holds true for democratic socialists. One of the things that they're doing, which I think Trump did, is that they're not trying to create a intellectually serious genealogy of where any of this stuff comes from. We talked about this. It was either last week or the week before. The DSA in 2021 put out a study of its members where the average age went from 63 or 83 or like 103 to something much younger.
Yeah, they were like Fox News viewers.
Yeah. But now it's like in the 30s, I think, or it might even be in the 20s. I think a lot of this is generational. And, you know, they're just saying, like, you know, we want to take control of various things like, you know, building policy, rent control. We want to take control of the airlines. We'll talk about all of the various things. And they don't care that these ideas have been not only tried, but thoroughly refuted within living memory. And Trump is kind of like that, too. Like, he was not bound by Republican Party propriety of saying, oh, well, that wouldn't be a Republican thing, or by Democratic Party failure in nationalizing things or whatever. And, you know, there's a huge amount of power to that. And, you know, so I don't disagree with Catherine that, like, we're talking about a pendulum here, but this is different than a kind of right wing, left wing pendulum. It's almost like strongman theory versus institutional theory or something. And like the institutions are so weak, if you come in and you have some energy and a pretty good smile, you know, you're going to get a lot of shit done before you get kicked out.
There's also a seminal piece that Reason published on this question, I think, in 2019, which was when Liz Nolan Brown went to this like gathering of socialists. And the headline on the piece was something like, socialists are more like libertarians than we would like to admit. And I think in that moment, she kind of nailed the this is their Tea Party moment. This is the moment where, you know, we have there's like momentum inside the socialist part of this institution. And as with the Tea Party moment, like, I assume they will fail to be socialist in exactly the same way that we, you know, that libertarians and their kind of electoral representatives failed to be fully libertarian once they had power. And in this case, that's a good thing.
I mean, David Hogg, who's a sort of young Democratic strategy type, actually called this the Democratic Tea Party moment. But Matt, I want to sort of ask you about a different way of thinking about the backlash politics here, because Nick framed this as a generational squabble, right? As a, you know, and I don't, so, you know, we've got this argument.
Clear, it's not a squabble. It's a change. The change boomer over, and Gen X era, I mean, it's over. And it doesn't mean there might still be a boomer or a Gen X president, all of that kind of stuff. But it's, you know, it's younger people's America.
But this is a backlash to the boomer, not just to Donald Trump, but to boomer Democrats, and in particular to the absolute crappiness, the dull, unexciting crappiness of the Democratic Party during the Biden and the Harris era.
I think that there's some truth to that. It's more fun to feel excitement about politics, especially if you are seeking in politics things that are not policy outcomes, which is the vast majority of people. It's a lesson we had to learn with Trump, with Bernie Sanders back in the day. And I think a lot of people in the kind of opinion journalism world still have a hard time wrapping their heads around the fact that that's not what the consumer experience of politics is necessarily driven by. So people want to feel that excitement. They're not feeling that excitement about Matt Mahan in California. They're feeling that excitement about Graham Plattner in Maine, and the rag bag of like Columbia grads that are now all over.
Tough week for Columbia.
Every week is a tough week for Columbia.
Every week.
And deservedly so. My father's alma mater. He's very sorry about all of it.
You know, in the New York context, too, one thing that's interesting is that Israel, attitudes towards Israel really played a big role. And even to a degree where Brad Lander did not get a DSA endorsement, but he did get a Mamdani one, and that was partly over Israel. And he's been floating around.
It's the price of doing business. I mean, a whole lot of the kind of woke left that we've talked about, you know, that sort of peak 2020 all of that identity politics has kind of gone away or collapsed into a single issue, and that issue is Free Palestine.
Yeah.
So that is the entry point for everybody here. It kind of doesn't matter what else you say on some level, just that you hate billionaires and Israel is committing genocide. It, cool, you're with us.
Well, and there was
Weird? Like, you, I just want to ask you guys, you two New Yorkers, these are New York elections, and they're coalescing around support for Israel? Or
well, actually support for for the elimination of Israel. It's not just New York, though, because is it Scott Wiener or the San Francisco guy who got hounded at a pro-trans rally, and he's like the most, by most accounts, is like the most effective legislator on trans issues in California, and he got hounded out of that because of Gaza issues.
Told that he wasn't an ally.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, this is amazing. There's also that big Senate primary in Michigan coming up, a Democratic candidate, you know, where Gaza or Palestine is going to be an issue. But I don't know that that translates even that well into Manhattan, because in Manhattan, like the district I'm in, New York 12, which had, you know, one of the biggest primaries, you know, in the Democratic Party this past week, I don't think Gaza was not as much of an issue as other stuff. So this may be very much a virus that is quarantined to Brooklyn, maybe to the parts of Harlem that Columbia, you know, has a reach on, and a couple of other places. But it is absolutely a huge part of it. And there's a generational issue or, you know, part to this, where younger people, whether they're Jewish or not, younger Americans have a much more negative or, you know, who gives a fuck attitude towards Israel than older Democrats and certainly Republicans.
Catherine, I want to get into some of the specific policy stuff in just a minute here. But before we get to that, I want to ask you about something that libertarians think about all the time, and it seems like no one else ever thinks about, which is if you give the government a power, you make a regulatory board, you make a rule, you make an office in charge of a thing, at some point, someone you don't like, don't trust, don't agree with is going to be in charge of that office. Because there are elections, because it's all pendulum, right? And it seems like with the sort of the DSA types, the DSA adjacent folks in New York, they have not yet had this thought. And I don't understand how they're like, the government should be in charge of absolutely everything in my life because one, I'm mad about it. Two, Donald Trump sucks. Well, imagine what happens when the successor to Donald Trump gets in office again and like is running this board. Like, can't they do the exercise in their head where it's like Ted Cruz is in charge of their life now?
I mean, I'll steel man some socialists for you. Sure. It's Monday. Let's do it. And I think that the answer is, of course, that is a problem when Ted Cruz is in charge of your life. Jesus Christ. I should.
Yeah, I also
think.
Don't want that to be clear.
Horrifying.
Not a socialist.
But I think that, that, you know, there's also kind of like a yes minister logic that is operating with the socialists, right? Like if you make a board, if you make a pile of civil servants somewhere, of course, you could be the politician in charge, could be entrepreneurial in the way that Donald Trump has been and really exploit every angle to use it for his own ends. But mostly bureaucracies have their own logic. And mostly that logic is to increase control and increase the kinds of things that the socialists want on balance. So I think they're, if you're making the case for what they're doing, they're saying like, yeah, okay, it could all go wrong. The other guys could win and sweep us away. But in the meantime, if we've installed the child care board and the rent control board and the food stamps board and the thing and the thing and the thing, a bunch of those things will just truck along doing vaguely social justice-y stuff for at least a while. And I don't think that's a terrible bet. That's kind of how things often operate.
All right, well, we're going to keep trucking along here. After a break, we are going to dig into the DSA policy playbook. Stick with us. Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners. Do you know a student looking for a serious intellectual experience that strengthens the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students ages 16 to 24 to the 2026 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago from July 25th to August 1st. This year's theme is Reason and Love. It explores the ideas that shape character, choice, and human flourishing. Students engage directly with thinkers like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, Alexis de Tocqueville. They'll be in small, dynamic discussion groups where every claim requires evidence and reasoning. They don't just sit through lectures. They're going to practice thinking for themselves. Outside the seminar room, students will have other activities they can explore: Chicago's landmarks, analyze art firsthand, experience live improv comedy, and build friendships rooted in shared intellectual ambition. Parents, if you want your student equipped to reason independently, speak confidently, and contribute meaningfully to a free society, this program was built for them. Registration is just $900, and that includes room for the full week. Scholarships are also available. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason. All right, let's talk about what the Democratic Socialists and their fellow travelers actually want to do. So before the show, I asked each panelist to please bring one, just one, policy or proposal pushed by a DSA-adjacent, DSA-friendly, sort of DSA-type politician. Nick, let's just start with you. What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about nationalizing the airlines, which Claire Valdez pushed. She's one of the people who won a Democratic primary in New York. And on a widely watched Twitter clip, she talked about getting rid of TSA PreCheck. And then she was like, you know, really, we should just nationalize the airlines. And I really admire.
Would you take that trade-off? No TSA, but the government runs all of the plane routes?
I like the idea of getting rid of TSA pre-check by getting rid of TSA. You know, we can walk this back finally to where every passenger is responsible for their own safety on a plane. I'm very jealous of people who are completely unburdened by history. And this is serious because part of the energy that's coming out of the DSA, out of New York, out of Mamdani, you know, like kind of the cloud that he has around him, is that they don't give a fuck about the recent past. And it's like, we know what nationalized airlines look like, and we know what heavily regulated airlines look like. I posted an interview I did with Vernon Smith, the Nobel Prize winning economist, a while ago after Jimmy Carter died, because Carter was instrumental in deregulating parts of airline, you know, the airline industry in the late 70s. And it is, everything is better now. There are more flights to more places. They're cheaper. They're safer. Flying, the big complaint about flying is that too many people are doing it, so flights are crowded. Oh, and it's not, you know, nobody, you don't hear pianos being played in the upper deck lounge anymore, and people don't dress up, and they don't bring out whole sides of beef to carve at your fucking table. That is the greatest policy success, or one of the greatest policy successes of my lifetime. And it is amazing to me that people are just like, oh yeah, no, you know what? Aeroflot, the Soviet airline, that's the way to go. That really should have survived the Soviet Union. It's insane, but that strikes me as part of our big project, is to remind everybody not of the ancient past and not of the classical virtues or the founding of America 250 years ago. It's to remember what things were like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, or even just now, which is the thing I want to talk about, which is Mamdani's big new rent control scheme. So last week, the New York City Rent Guidelines Board voted to freeze the rent for 1 million apartments in the city. Right, this was one of Mamdani's big campaign promises. It applies to both 1 and 2 year leases. It prevents rent increases for more than 40% of apartments in the city. So nearly half of the apartments in the city right now. And this is just more rent control like we've seen before, except it's rent control on steroids. And it's going to fail, and it's going to cause all the unintended consequences that we've seen from rent control over the past however many decades, right? It hasn't worked. And one thing, like, it's not just that the studies will show you that it hasn't worked. And just about every study is extremely clear on the unintended consequences of rent control. We've had rent control for 50 years in New York. Have you seen the rent in New York? You just need to try to rent an apartment is the way to figure, like, to see that this stuff is not working, that it is causing. Basically, it means that developers don't have an incentive to either build housing, or if they do have an incentive, it's to only build very expensive luxury housing. And then you get a market that looks like New York's, which is incredibly expensive. which has some very sort of high-end apartments and almost nothing else. And there's a huge housing shortage. And this is just going to exacerbate that. It's also going to do something else that's kind of interesting. It's almost certainly going to trigger a legal case on takings, because basically, especially for like outer borough apartments, this is going to make it very difficult financially. It's not going to pencil out for developers to renovate in between tenants. And it's going to take the value of those apartments, not just down somewhat, but in many cases, down to zero. And for legal purposes, if the property you own is made completely worthless by the government, that's a taking. And so there's at least a possibility that this goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is like, nah, rent control in New York as we know it, it's not constitutional. That could be fun. Catherine, you have something for us?
You just painted a picture that sounds so delightful to me, like New York rent control versus SCOTUS. I really, really, really would love to see that. Unlike some people,
IJ is already working on it.
Unlike some people, I live in Washington, D.C., so I want to talk about what's happening here. We got our own socialists. Actually, Trump called her a communist, I think, this morning. And it's the Democratic primary winner for the mayoral race. This is Janice Lewis-George, and she wants to do a lot of things, but one of them is childcare. She wants to redo childcare in D.C. So many promises, none of them even remotely deliverable. She wants to cap family costs for childcare at 7% of income. This is really, really difficult to do, especially when you are pairing it with giving childcare workers the same wages as DCPS. And also, she's going to figure out how to use all the unused school space, which exists in part because of defection to charter schools and a bunch of other things. But the worst part is she's going to pay friends, family, and neighbors to do childcare. How are we going to do that? Don't worry about it. There's going to be a lot of paperwork, probably. It'll be fine. We're going to take this massive and fluid and like actually really functional sector of the economy that exists in an informal gray market, and we are going to turn all of those people into furious and underpaid, over-paperworked government contractors. It's fine. It's fine. Wait,
do you think they're going to be underpaid, or are they going to be overpaid unionized workers? Because one of the knocks on George is that she is just a tool for the unions, that like the local public sector unions loved her, endorsed her, and that there was no point at which she crossed any of those unions.
This is potentially a play to dump people into that pool, but I think it is actually more likely that the people who are providing this care, a bunch of them just like will never be able to navigate the system. And they're going to have to make it hard to navigate the system to get paid. Because if you literally paid somebody every time they left their kid at their aunt's house and went out for dinner, like that's bonkers. That's like a genuinely crazy thing to do.
So is this great news for your mom?
Can they turn the babies? They can have the kids become the delivery robots, and that way they stave off automation, and you have like little kids crawling on the streets delivering pizzas.
Yes, child labor is always the solution to both child care and labor problems. Everyone knows that
most of human history, right?
Bonkers, huge, huge subsidy program. It's not technically a sort of entitlement in the purest sense. And I don't think it will ever be implemented in a way that's really happening, you know, meaningfully across the board. But it is a really bad and like wildly distortionary proposal.
But if we weren't sending billions of dollars to Israel, we'd be able to afford the babysitter robots, right, Matt?
Yeah. So this is less of a specific policy proposal, more kind of like a stated, commonly stated instinct and a way of not thinking about how actual policy is spent. In an interview this week, Daria Lisa Avila Chevalier, and I'm getting better at that, DAC, said that, you know, I'm not going to listen to people say that we don't have money for public education when we're sending all of this money to a genocidal war machine in Israel. And it's interesting to think about that for a second, because we give $4 billion a year to Israel. In the last couple of years, there's been an additional $10 billion supplemental. So let's say, smooth it out, $15 billion a year to Israel. New York City, where she is representing now, spends $45 billion a year just on K-12. The country as a whole spends more than $1 trillion a year on K-12. And the problem with K-12 is not that it's not spending enough money. There is no system in the universe that spends more money per child than New York City right now. And in fact, they would be spending even more, and Mom Donnie's budget would be even more in the red had they not kicked down the timeline a couple of years, a stupid law passed by socialist-leaning Democrats in New York about class sizes that would have mandated hiring even more teachers for a system that peaked in students well over 10 years ago and is declining. So we're spending more money on K through 12 education every year and getting the worst results in big Democrat-run cities. Meanwhile, it pales in it absolutely dwarfs the amount of money that we spend giving aid to Israel right now. And that's the type of thing that Democratic socialists and Democrats spend very little time actually talking about, with the occasional sporadic exception of Rahm Emanuel.
Well, there's also there's about $1 trillion in means-tested anti-poverty programs from the federal government, too. I was actually kind of buoyed by this because it means that DAK is partway there. She's attacking DAC or DAK? So DAC is attacking the warfare state. And now if she can get back to David Stockman when he was a congressman from Michigan who would attack the welfare warfare state, we're partway there. So, I mean, for me, this is green shoots in the socialist uprising, because we should be spending less on defense and we should be spending a lot less and doing it much more efficiently on anti-poverty programs.
I'd feel better about all of that if she hadn't expressed some sympathy for Vladimir Putin being pushed to invade Ukraine by the United States and the usual ragbag of idiot lefty Trumps.
You know, I like to think it was my comments online that actually pushed Putin to invade Ukraine. So
we have socialists against the warfare state and against the TSA. Maybe they really are more like libertarians than we all thought. Catherine, Liz Nolan Brown was right. The question I want to ask before we move on here is whether there is a real meaningful distinction between the kind of the up and coming socialist types in the Democratic Party and the mainstream Democratic Party. Because I do think that this was in many ways a kind of reaction to the sort of Democratic Party, the legacy party under Biden, right? And you know, to the sort of boring, like dull, unfun centrists. At the same time, I see the kind of fantasy economics that are coming out of the DSA as maybe Elizabeth Warren hasn't gone full-fledged, you know, chevalier here, but that stuff is getting closer to the Democratic Party center. Am I crazy here, or are they crazy?
What do we see with Biden? Biden ran as a centrist compared to all the wackaloons on his left in 2020, but then governed almost from day one on a much more kind of wackaloon, let's just sort of invent new ways to forgive all of student loan debt and things that were not necessarily in play on the campaign trail. So when the heart of the Democratic Party is moving in this direction and the infrastructure and the bodies, the people who are going to staff up your administrations are like this. You'd see this in Virginia too, under Spanberger, like people who campaign as centrists have a really hard time governing as centrists actually anymore.
Yeah, we're going to get abundance socialism. Catherine's going to love it. All right. It is once again time to check in on Catherine's favorite question. Is the Strait of Hormuz open this week? We're supposed to be over by now, Catherine. We're not supposed to have this segment anymore. Trump promised that the Strait would be open and there'd be no tolls. We had a peace deal. But I read this weekend, we're shooting at Iran again. They're shooting at us.
Yeah, it is now the Strait of Schrodinger. It is open and not open. Somebody tweeted that at me this week as a helpful tool to give me in the war against you, Peter, which is now how I think of this segment. But we can talk about it. Okay, so the Strait was actually more open at the end of last week than it has been in a while. Like, more ships actually went through it. It was opener, I guess. But we now only have war with Iran on the weekends, like for fun, to blow off steam, like as a little treat. And then
literalizing
by Monday,
the idea of weekend warriors.
We are literal weekend warriors, because by Monday we need to have the war wrapped up before the markets open so that nobody freaks out. So I think now we can say it on Mondays. On the podcast, we can say, yes, the Strait is open, because that's the schedule we've agreed on with ourselves.
This has got to be like the first the first war where there was more fighting during the during the cessation of violence than during the actual war itself. I mean, we can't stand another peace treaty, right?
Yeah. I feel like humanity has done this before. I don't have the example, but we love to say one thing and do another, just as a species. Yeah.
I would point out amidst all of this scoffing that Lebanon and Israel signed a pretty major peace deal brokered by the United States 4 days ago or 5 days ago. Whether it lasts is, of course, the trillion-dollar question, but it's very significant to deal between those two, most significant deal in four decades. Part of it would exchange Israel withdrawing from parts of South Lebanon and Hezbollah disarming. Hezbollah doesn't sound like they're going to disarm, but it's significant. So I'm like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. You guys see the joke on one of the social media sites about how Trump just loves to talk about how he ends wars. The last couple of months, he's ended 14 wars. It just turns out that's all the same war. Yeah, that's why we keep asking this question, Catherine. All right, when we come back, listener question about movies, also unions and fundamental economic fairness right after this. So we all know that Argentina has become the world's most closely watched experiment in free market reform. Inflation is falling, economic growth is returning, and policymakers around the world are watching closely to see whether a country that has long been associated with economic dysfunction can chart a new course toward prosperity. And now you have the chance to hear about this remarkable transformation from the people who are making it happen. Reason, that's Reason Magazine, where I work, is bringing together leading thinkers, reformers, policymakers, journalists, and advocates of liberty for a very special conference in Buenos Aires. It's called The Winds of Change, Advancing Liberty in Argentina and the Americas. From August 31st through September 3rd, conference participants will gather in Argentina's capital city, and they'll hear directly from the people shaping one of the most important economic and political stories of our time. So if you would like to join Reason in Buenos Aires and be part of an incredible conversation, visit reason.org/Argentina2026 for more information and registration details. Again, that is reason.org/Argentina2026. We hope to see you in Buenos Aires, August 31st through September 3rd for the Winds of Change, Advancing Liberty in Argentina and the Americas Conference. Okay, it is once again time for our listener question of the week. A reminder, we too love to answer your questions. So please send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long questions to podcast@reason.com. That's podcast@reason.com. And thank you so much to all of you putting the words listener question in the subject line. This week's listener question comes from Joey. Like I said, it's about movies. So in some ways it's directed at me, but I think there are some sort of libertarian policy ideas or sort of philosophical ideas embedded here. Joey writes, recently, the head of the art department on micro-budgeted obsession lamented her pay of $300 a day with no mileage when the movie is grossing over $250 million at the box office. If this sentiment takes off, what does this mean for small independent film productions? John Cassavetes gave percentage points on the back end for some of his films. Even Marvel is famously moving their studios from Atlanta to the United Kingdom to avoid union costs. Not everyone lives in Los Angeles, but not all good ideas conveniently come from a place where cost of living is affordable. So what's the libertarian answer for serving your crew fairly while also making a movie on the budget you have? Catherine, has anybody here seen the movie Obsession? I haven't, actually. I've not been able to see it. Nobody's seen it. All right. So, Catherine, I want to start with you because this is a management question in many ways, right? How do you treat your staff fairly, even if they agreed to something that feels unfair after you see the outcome of the product?
I deeply hate that you came to me first, but I'll try. I think my answer here is like, seems like you should learn a lesson when something like this happens and negotiate some upside on the back end in your contract if your project that you worked on breaks out. I don't know. Like, clearly, if everywhere had really strong union protections and super complicated contracts that were mandated as minimum conditions for working on any project, Obsession would not have been made. I assume that's the kind of thing that usually is true, or maybe not this specific movie, but like smaller
movies. The union
movies
people
that
would
only
argue
get made.
Otherwise, but I'll talk a little bit more
wrong.
About this.
They would be incorrect. Like at on the margin, it is just obviously true that if you mandate a floor for compensation, then the things that would have been made below that level don't get made. So I feel like comfortable on the very basic level there. And I kind of feel like, yeah, this is a terrible story for this person and she should get a bonus or whatever. If I were the person holding the checkbook of this production, I would give her a bonus. I would have given her a bonus before she went to the media, actually. But this just not really strike me as a question for public policy.
Nick, what do you think?
It reminded me of the makeup budget supposedly for Dallas Buyers Club, which cost like $5 million to make. It was actually a low budget movie despite the star power in it, but it was like $250. And it mostly consisted around Matthew McConaughey starving himself and then a really good makeup artist. And I don't know what she got out of that, but I'm sure her stock rose within Hollywood. And, you know, it seems to me that's what happens. Like when you're part of a breakout hit, I don't know that the San Francisco mime troupe or the hippies in the commune in Easy Rider are still bitching and moaning that Dennis Hopper went to the grave with all the money from that or not. Like, you know, but it's, you know, it, to echo what Catherine said, I don't think this is a policy issue. It is kind of a management thing, and I would think that the people involved in the production would spread around a lot of extra, you know, bonuses or taking people out to Chipotle and letting them get the avocado and stuff. But the main thing here is like you did something really great, make that your calling card and build a career out of it rather than grousing that I was involved in this one stroke of lightning that did fantastically well and I'm going to bitch and moan for the rest of my life about how I didn't get, you know, royalties on it, which reminds me of somebody like Robert Crumb, who would never shut up about the Keep on Trucking figure being ripped off or that he only got paid $50 or $75 to do the Cheap Thrills album cover. And, you know, he seemed to work out pretty well because he kept producing.
Matt, one of the complaints about this is that it's a kind of rich get richer story because this movie made a huge, huge amount of money on a very small budget. And at least one sort of Hollywood super producer who signed on to this project late in the game ended up pocketing a pretty big chunk of cash where the crew is in some cases not here. So like, does that change you sort of like how you think about this? Is that like there's, you know, horror super producers who are getting extreme, who had nothing to do with the actual making of the movie, signed on, right? Like this is but this is the complaint. And this is, I think this is just to bring this back to the conversation we started with. This is a core resentment at the heart of the elections that we saw in your city last week.
Yeah, I don't think that breakout indie movies was a big core complaint of it. I mean, certainly Zoran Mamdani knows
about... But it's rich guys who are getting richer.
I don't think we're going to see Exodus made again anytime soon.
No, I mean, like the libertarian arguments or anything that we have to say about this should come down to there shouldn't be subsidies for films. That's dumb. That's garbage. There's now,
that's true.
I think Gavin Newsom is or other idiot Rokana type people are talking about having a national subsidy to keep American films in America or something. I think Trump has probably also voiced something like that. All of that is terrible. All these competing things. There's the extensive amounts of research that's been done on this, as well as stuff like rent control, showing that you're just sloshing movies monies around because you decided that this one industry was sexy as opposed to all the other industries that aren't. And so like, stop doing that. That's bad. That's wrong. The Hollywood system has always worked as like, you can have a union crew. You can have a non-union crew. They're actually pretty flexible about that. You could do low budge stuff. You can get the star to come in and agree to work on scale, or you cannot. And then you can cash in. A lot of like little clutches of teams start working on a thing and they get one success and then they all stick together as they all realize they can get better and better, better. Spike Lee did this with 40 Acres and a Mule, whatever his production company was from the beginning, because he was making profitable films and they all rose with him for at least for a while. That's just sort of the normal Hollywood thing. What on earth are we talking about public policy about this otherwise? This is just the types of things that people are negotiating themselves with. It's very difficult for my friends who work in building sets in California right now. Production has definitely gone down. I don't think that the public policy initiatives about that have improved things or stand to improve things like that. And as for like producers getting rich, my dude, Do we know anything about Hollywood? No. Like, do we know anything about Hollywood?
It's such a famously ethical industry.
Producers
too, up until
and egalitarian.
To your point, though, Peter, I think you're right that there is a politics of wealth resentment that gets talked a lot about. I don't actually think that was pushing a lot of stuff in New York, because it was about Israel and it was about housing affordability. It's like everybody hates the fact that they think they're paying a lot for, you know, the particular apartment they're in. And again, I think we, you know, one of the functions that Reason serves is kind of talking about why things cost the way they, you know, what they do and how you can make markets more efficient, meaning that they serve more people at different price points in more varied ways. But I think that the DSA wants people to be like, you know, the reason why we hate trillionaires, you know, is because they have ill-gotten gains. I think the vast overwhelming majority of people don't give a shit about what other people are making as long as they feel like they are getting theirs. And the fact is that we spend a lot of money in after-tax transfers to like even things out, and people in America are still doing well. But if we give in to a politics of wealth resentment, it's going to lead to policies that are really destructive.
Look, you live in New York, and obviously Israel was a big part of the recent elections there. But look at that Mamdani video in front of Ken Griffin's apartment. The policy issue, the public policy, the issue that is driving a lot of public policy and a lot of elections in America right now, but specifically the Mamdani adjacent, DSA adjacent elections, is that feels unfair. And there's nothing more than that. It's just that feels unfair. That's what this question is about.
But
that's what the gripe is from the, you know, from the woman who worked on this movie.
The policy is a dumb form of rent stabilization. On top
and
of
then, and then you get one. A policy that has been proven to not work.
Yes.
To respond
but
to
it's
that.
About, but it's because it's because people feel like it's not fair to pay $4,000 in rent for a two bedroom apartment, et cetera. If you had a functioning housing market, a lot of the energy towards, you know what? I can't stand the fact that, you know, certain people who run venture firms or whatever are making $1 billion. I think that goes away. And this is something that Trump harped on in 2016, along with Hillary Clinton. The system is broken. You know, you can do everything right. You can work 40 hours a week and you'll never afford a house. You'll be robbed at gunpoint. All of this type of stuff. All of these large narratives are fundamentally false, and they're built on resentment. And I do think we need to push back on them, you know, in the sense of like, you know, younger people are not being priced out of housing. They started buying houses a little bit later, but like Gen Z is actually, they own houses at a faster rate than Gen X or boomers did. So like, you know, we need to keep the resentment talk in line with reality. And most of the time it doesn't match up.
Yeah. The one thing I did want to add here is this was fundamentally a question about film financing. And Catherine basically made the point that I wanted to make, which is that if you make these productions more expensive by unionizing them, which the craft union, IATSE, often shows up on day one of your non-union production and tries to flip you to a union production, which is going to add 10, 20, 25, I don't know the exact number, but it's going to add percentages to your total cost. If you make all of these non-union productions union, then at the margins, there will be fewer of them, which means fewer jobs for people who want to break into the film industry. But even if you manage to do that, you make all these non-union productions union, the other thing that's going to happen is people have opportunities to make things and to do things outside of the studio, Hollywood, even the sort of traditional independent film system. There was an incredible profile in the Wall Street Journal just recently about a former drug dealer in Atlanta who is now just making essentially sort of gangster soap operas for like YouTube and ad-supported streamers. And he's pulling down $300,000-$400,000 a year himself, putting most of that money into property in Virginia for his family. And he's like, yeah, you know, I was a drug dealer for a while. And then I started writing fiction. Fiction didn't sell well, but, you know, look, but I figured out that I could adapt this dirt cheap into film. And it's the same thing. You're just, you know, making product for people who want it, just like dealing drugs. Incredible piece. And he's working, it's all non-union because he's just doing it entirely, you know, sort of out of his own pocket, like making it happen. on his own. And people are going to find ways to do that. And the unions are not ever going to be able to compete with that. They're never not ever going to be able to stop with that, stop that entirely, because it's a free country and you can just go out and shoot something and make it your own and not have to follow those rules. So in any case, the film financing, like, it will work itself out because people want to make movies. And that's how it's always been. And that's how it is going to be in the future here. Okay, let's move on to our final topic here. As I mentioned at the top of the show, America is about to have a big birthday, 250 years. So besides lamenting the rise of socialism, I want to know how we are celebrating. And I want to start with you, Catherine, because Reason celebrated with a whole magazine
banger
on the 250th anniversary.
We did. And it's a good one, you guys. So I think personally, you should celebrate by reading Reason's 250th issue. You can do that if you're already a subscriber. You should have it in your hands. If you're not, you could subscribe and get a digital edition. And that would be fun. You can also read a bunch of the pieces on our website now because they have been rolled out. The cover story I particularly recommend, it's called The First Free Americans. It's by Charles Mann. And it's just a great, great history piece about the ways that the idea of freedom kind of percolated around in the founding era, including kind of the real and imagined governance practices of Native Americans. We got a big piece in there about a cool gun. We got everybody's favorite founders. We have some delightful, delightful stuff in this issue. So including some Matt Welsh, who is our favorite founder expert. So he's probably a good celebrator of the 250th as well. Apparently, what you should not do is go down to the National Mall and get on the Ferris wheel. Reason's Billy Binion wrote about his experience at the National, what is it called, State Fair, which is on the mall here in D.C. He got
can it be both national and state?
The National yes, State County Fair.
The National State Fair. It's the State National National yeah. State Fair of Federalism for America. And Billy describes himself at one point as a ripe little cherry tomato because he is so hot and trapped in the Ferris wheel. So don't do that. Also, apparently they don't have funnel cake. So what is the point?
Wow.
But yeah. America is great. The 250th issue
is
great.
I thought this was America. Thank
you. Yeah. I know. I don't think it's legal to have a state fair without funnel cake.
Yeah, that's a law I support.
There's
that's
no
the one.
Fried dough. Or
I mean, the word on the street is that the fried dough situation is lacking.
All right. I think we need a funnel cake subsidy. Matt Welch, how are you celebrating the 250th here this weekend?
Kind of been celebrating for the last 2 years. And
alcoholism is not a national celebration.
Speak for yourself. Quit.
It's a lifestyle.
So probably going to watch some Tall Ships on July 4th sale. Through the East River, which is really a tidal wash, Nick, go to a party on July 3rd for July 4th and continue watching the Tom Hanks thing on Netflix, which I saw the first bit last night, and it's fine. It's very good. It's nice to see someone not Ken Burns do it. You live July 4th every day, man. And I'm going to be celebrating nonstop.
Fireworks at the end. Tall Ships in the middle. There's actually Tall Ships going to be coming into the Boston Harbor. And you kind of see them from the North Shore area where near where I'm staying. So I'm pretty excited about that. Nick, how are you celebrating?
I am going to buy a bunch of firecrackers in Chinatown and light them off in Matt Welch's mailbox.
Yeah.
Thereby committing a federal crime.
Mm-hmm.
But having a lot of fun. I'm going to be
that's your July 4th everyday strategy?
Pretty much. Yeah. You know, why wait for the holidays, you know? And then when people expect it, I am mildly annoyed that July 4th is being celebrated on Friday, even if that's the actual day. I like my long weekends to include Monday. Having said that, I will be strolling around various parts of Manhattan with my wife and 6-month-old son. So it will be his first and only, hopefully, only 4th of July where he's not able to walk on his own.
Baby's first heat stroke.
Because that's right. Yeah. Well, maybe not degrees. The first, but close yeah. to the first.
Six-month-olds love screaming parades followed by explosions. Right. So good luck
where
with
they,
that.
And they can't, you know, you can't give them ice cream. You can't really do anything other than, you know, put a cover over them and ignore the screams and cries while they fall asleep on the stroller.
You can also go inside where it is air conditioned because USA. This is America.
Come on. Now this... The one thing I want to say is we'll be participating in all sorts of stuff in New York, which more than Philadelphia, where I've lived, and Boston, which I loathe, and DC, which doesn't really count, but I've also lived. New York is the real epicenter of American 4th of July. And it's where the city, you know, it became the biggest, most important city in the country. Very quickly, it remains that because people don't care. People don't give a fuck, and they're going to do what they're going to do. And I think that's great. So that I live every
day. That's the American way. I do appreciate you trying to have a Boston-New York rivalry here, but I'm not going to take
the bait.
That's
not much of a rivalry, actually.
Yeah.
Well, now let's move on to our final segment. Cultural recommendations. What we have been watching, reading, game playing, viewing in museums, reading, otherwise consuming in the cultural realm. Matt Welch, you want to start?
Yeah, I mentioned this last week. I finished it last night. A quickie three-part documentary on Netflix that came out 3 weeks ago called Michael Jackson, The Verdict. And it's just about the Michael Jackson trial of 2004, whenever that happened. And it is commendable because it's like an old-timey documentary where they just kind of interview everybody on all sides and they don't tell you what to think. It's just old-fashioned journalism and it's great. So they have some of the defense lawyers, they have the prosecutor who kind of bungled up, they have some of the journalists who are covering it, people who work for Michael Jackson and defend him, people who work for Michael Jackson and flipped and came out the other side of it. Friends of the family they get a pretty good cross section of people. And at various times you find yourself like, oh man, he really did it. And then sometimes like, maybe he didn't, which is great. And, but it's just a fine documentary. And, from what I understand reading up about it this morning, has the lowest ever score, on Rotten Tomatoes. Because people,
is that because it didn't tell people what to think? Because people want to be told what to think?
No, because people want to really love Michael, the movie, and MJ, the musical, and they don't want to hear about all this stuff because he's innocent. Why are we even talking about this? You're trying to take advantage of his research and popularity, et cetera, et cetera. But it's real fine. It's a fine documentary. Michael Jackson, The Verdict. Go watch it.
Please spoil it for us, Matt Welch. What's the verdict?
You know, he was found innocent of all the charges, Nick.
Okay. Yeah. So is he searching for the real molesters? Or?
No, he died like 4 years later after not really doing anything else with his life, except racking up gigantic debts.
Is there anything, Matt and I were talking about this before we began, it's an ongoing conversation I have with a lot of people, but is there anything that an artist could do where you would be like, yeah, I'm just not going to consume that person's work anymore?
I just like the mamas and the papas, if it comes on the radio, I'm still not turning it off necessarily, and I don't even like them. But you know, John Phillips is as close to Hitler as you're going to find in a pop singer,
and a dad,
yeah. and yet, you know, it's just music. So same thing with Michael Jackson. I came out of that. My verdict was that I think he might have had some problems with some boys, but I'm still listening to his music because it's great.
Wait, so are you an aficionado of Hitler's paintings then?
No, but I'm not really about the visual arts, Peter.
Yeah.
And that's
terrible
why.
Taste in movies.
The reason I'm not that into Hitler's paintings is because visual arts aren't for me.
I'm trying to, we've got to test. We've already invoked Hitler, so you can't, the line has been crossed.
God
means you
podcast.
Have to test the limit. And Hitler was an artist, right? So we're going to ask.
Please, I beg you.
We're going to ask Catherine to save us.
Hi, I read a novel. Sometimes I walk by Kramer Books and there are books in the window and I like to read them just to know what the people are reading, where the people is a very specific subset of the people, which is the people who buy the books in Kramer Books' window in DuPont Circle.
Oh, yeah, the normies.
The normies. So I read If You're Seeing This, It's Meant for You, a novel by Lee Stein. And here's the thing, guys. I was seeing it and it was meant for me because it's actually a novel about a bunch of things that are very relevant. First of all, it is set in a thinly veiled, crumbling Frank Lloyd Wright house, which is a longstanding interest of mine, inherited from my architect father and shored up by Ayn Rand's love of Frank Lloyd Wright. it is about trying to make content that will succeed on social media in an era when you are constantly trying to run ahead of the algorithms and not fully understand them. That is relevant to my life here at Reason Magazine, where we have a lot of social media channels. You should subscribe to them, by the way. Listeners, if you don't already, we are on Instagram and TikTok and YouTube Shorts and all those places. And we are trying to figure out how to make content that people like there. Also, a little skosh of magical realism, which I do enjoy. And most of the plot hinges around tarot, which we have like an influencer who's a tarot fortune teller.
Yeah.
And
a witch.
While
we call
I
them
do
witches.
Not think she's more like... there's a ghostly possession situation rather than a witch, I would say. It's a subtle but important distinction. As someone who does not think that tarot cards can tell you the future, but does enjoy a little secular tarot for journaling purposes, because that's what I'm up to now, guys, as a 45-year-old woman with purple hair. I didn't see that coming either, and I enjoyed it in this book. If any of that sounded appealing to you, and I can see why it might not, if you're a listener of the Reason Roundtable, I recommend, if you're seeing this, it's meant for you by Lee Stein. If not, you could watch Matt's dad thing instead.
So is the tarot and the journaling and the witch adjacency, is that like because of us?
No. What?
Oh, okay.
Wow.
It's not about you, Peter.
Yeah. Golly. I will second. I have my own recommendation, but Lee Stein's latest book is just a great satire. She's a fantastic writer. I also recommend her autobiography. But what I really loved about the book is it being set in L.A., and it has really great Eve Babbitt's kind of Joan Didion vibes, but very much in a social media space. It's just... really funny, as well as really creepy and just kind of wonderful.
There's also a great ongoing bit about how absolutely horrible it is to own a pet rabbit. Like, yeah. Just terrible pets, it turns out.
Which is totally true. Yeah.
There are two Reason staffers who are sometime rabbit owners. So
please don't tell us who they are. I mean, I know Matt is obviously
a mystery.
One of them. Yeah. But.
People can write in on the comments and guess.
That's a good one.
Whomst is the rabbit owner? It's not me.
So my recommendation is a new book by Jason Silva, who is a Venezuelan-born psychedelic kind of guru influencer. He worked for Current TV way, way back. There's an old Reason TV interview with him. Jason has a phenomenal stream of content that's mostly... I consume it mostly on Instagram and whatnot, but he wrote a book called The Ecstatic States of America, A Manifesto for a New Country of the Mind, which is very good to read around Independence Day, because what is fantastic, he says this is about liberty, consciousness, and ecstasy. It's very consciously a throwback to a late 60s moment when people like Timothy Leary were talking about the politics of ecstasy and whatnot. And this, he talks about how the first time that psychedelics came along, it went wrong. The psychedelic revolution didn't happen for a variety of reasons, but we're better situated to kind of have our minds expanded in a way that becomes socially productive, culturally productive, and whatnot. One of the things that I love about this book, which you can get on Amazon and whatnot, but is that it's about America and it is about the New World, kind of the Western Hemisphere. And it's interesting to think about like how you slice up the world. And so many things that are related to consciousness expansion and particularly psychedelic drugs are New World phenomenon. And, you know, that's we should be taking that figuratively more than literally, even though, you know, mushrooms and ayahuasca and ergot, I mean, they're all over the place. But it's a New World phenomenon of like where you want to live in a world that you can imagine and create and then move on from. It's just The Ecstatic States of America is the type of upbeat, positive messaging about what is possible in a world when you start to think differently about things. It's just wonderful. So I recommend Jason Silva's The Ecstatic States of America.
Speaking of ecstatic and what is possible, I watched the fifth season of The Bear. This is the final season of a show about working in a restaurant in Chicago that is converted into a high-end, you know, Michelin star aspiring kind of fancy place from being a just lowly beef chain. And it is fantastic. Just a phenomenal show. It is what it is, maybe the only show that every season has had at least one episode that has brought me literal tears of joy to my eyes, right? Like it hits me so hard. And this, like, the show is about something that I think all of us sort of deal with and think about at Reason here all the time, which is about the desire to create something wonderful in the world. And just the extreme sort of the necessity of doing so, and also how hard it is to do that generally, and how much even harder if you're really good at it, how hard it is to do it without being a jerk, because you're so single-mindedly focused on doing the thing, and you have to do it in the moment. And this is really especially true in the restaurant industry, where there's no kind of time for sitting around and thinking about it. Like, once you get to people in your restaurant, that food has to be made. There's not an extra 10 minutes to spare. And so that means that people talk over each other. That means that people are sort of, you know, they're rude in so many cases. And so much of this drama in the show just comes from this push and pull between everybody wants on the show to do something excellent and wonderful, and they're all capable of it. And also, they have to find some way to work in harmony together. And the fifth season really nails this and really gets it, how difficult that is, but how wonderful and how magical it is when you can find not just that you're making something on your own, not just that you're making it for yourself, but you are making it for other people in conjunction with a sort of a team that becomes a kind of, you know, a hive mind, an octopus, a many-armed creature that is working perfectly together. And those moments when you find them in a creative field, in a creative endeavor, there's just nothing like it. There's nothing like this show, I think, really, that I've seen on television in a very, very long time. This is the fifth and final season of The Bear. I haven't actually seen the very final episode. I'm going to watch it tonight. Very excited to do so. All right, folks, that is our show. If you like what we do, you can support us at reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Every week on this podcast, we try to make something wonderful for you. Thank you, as always, for listening. The Reason Roundtable will return.